health industry groups are expected to deliver.
If you like the plan you have, you can keep it.
To take over the healthcare system, either directly or indirectly, for the government to control it.
A lot of my friends, where they get their health care from is the emergency room. They're in the emergency room every week. They break a nail in the emergency room.
How are you going to avoid not having the ability to cost shift as you shrink that portion of privately funded health insurance?
Well, cable news last night was wall-to-wall Mark Sanford, but as you can hear in the music that's been motivating our conversations about health care reform, President Obama last night was at a town meeting on ABC News talking health care reform.
This is not an easy problem. If it was easy, it would have been solved a long time ago, because we've been talking about this for decades, since Harry Truman.
The president really was talking through the kinds of changes and behavioral changes on the part of patients and doctors and legislators and hospitals that are going to have to happen if real change can take place. It was an interesting exercise in both the psychological hand-holding on the part of the president and policy discussion. And we're joined now by Bernice Pesco-Solido. Pesco-Solido, she's a distinguished professor of sociology at Indiana University, director of the Indiana Consortium for Mental Health Services Research. Bernice, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You know, we wanted to talk with you about the models for healthcare reform. The town meeting last night was really about tiptoeing towards the edge of a real change, and you could hear a lot of the fear in the questions and even in some of the answers. What do you think are some good models for the kinds of things that have already been suggested in the initial debate in Washington?
Well, I think part of the problem is that people are worried about the wholesale transportation of models from other countries to our country. In fact, in the study that we did, only about 38% of Americans want to see any kind of government intervention in healthcare. And if you compare that with Norway, there was 90%. And I think that this fear is really unfounded, because public the change in the healthcare system really has to be done in the context of our culture.
Right.
And I think Obama understands that. And
well,
I don't.
He said particularly about that statistic you just mentioned, that a lot of people are more comfortable with the devil they have than the devil
that's
they
right.
don't know. Do you think that's a legitimate characterization of how people maybe aren't totally satisfied with the plan they have, but they're much more afraid of what they might get?
Absolutely. In our study, the biggest thing that shaped how people feel about healthcare and healthcare change was the system they grew up in. They're afraid to have a major change in the system that they grew up in.
Even if they're paying more for it?
Yes. And they, in fact, in America, there are only 14% who want to see the government spend more. And I don't really see how we're going to change the system if we don't have some kind of investment. It's not clear to me how Americans think the system can how we're going to fix this without some kind of change, either in spending habits or in how we fund the system.
Now, if we talk about changing habits, that's an argument for mandates and serious regulations that the government would come in and basically set the domain wherein hospitals and patients and doctors can operate. But if you're also talking about other significant changes, like reducing healthcare costs, maybe the mantra there should be get out of the business of a for-profit healthcare system, which would make the United States more like the rest of the world. Do you see a one or the other here, or is it kind of a mishmash?
I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think we're going to see any massive change in the kind of healthcare that we have. But I think one thing that Americans have to do is realize that we're all paying for the uninsured. You know, we have 44 million uninsured. If we don't do anything right now, by 2019, we're going to have 54 million uninsured. And our healthcare premiums reflect having to pay for people who go to the emergency room. They're not getting good care, good or appropriate care at the emergency room for the kind of problems that they bring. And our health premiums, health insurance premiums, are going up because of having to keep the system solvent.
How much of the frustration in the debate, and again, it's just getting started in Washington, and we do recall what happened in 1994
yes.
where things totally fell apart. How much of this is less about the fears of consumers and really about the inability of Congress in the 21st century to handle serious social legislation on the order of Social Security, on the order of the enormous changes that took place in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, Civil Rights Act. These are radical changes that it's almost impossible to imagine Congress tackling in our era.
Well, I think that American public policy tends to operate by crisis. And it does seem that at the moment that we really are at a critical point. And I think the reason why Americans are uncomfortable is because we don't know the details. But I think the lesson of the Clinton attempt to change healthcare was that all the details were worked out in advance, not by Congress, not with response from the people. And so the kind of lack of detail that we see in Obama's plan actually reflects the lesson learned from the failure of the Clinton healthcare reform.
Well, it's interesting, and he actually referred to that. Listen to the president. He's speaking last night at the town hall meeting on ABC News.
What's lacking is not knowledge. We've been debating this stuff for decades. What's lacking is political will. Genuine change generally does not come from Washington. Whether we like it or not, it comes from the American people saying it's time for us to move forward. And I think this is that moment.
Can serious policy be driven by some American people writing into their congressmen and demanding change?
I don't think so. The health of the history of health care in the United States suggests that it's really the people who organize the health care system. And that doesn't mean just doctors. It does mean politicians. It does mean the state. It does mean the people who finance the system, that they make the changes. But they can only do that in the context of a culture that will support or not support that.
Well, let me hand you a big bucket of stuff that we've talked about over the last few weeks. There's the VA system, which is great on electronic records. There's the Michigan kind of pooling of resources to bulk buy medical services and prescription drugs. There's the Mayo Clinic's disciplined approach to health care and how it reduces costs. And there's lots more I could go into. There's the German regulatory system. There's the Canadian system. Mix or match. What are we going to take as a model here?
We're going to end up with a uniquely American system. It doesn't mean that we can't learn. In fact, I think we know, and I think one of the things we're going to see for sure is that we're going to move toward electronic records. But I think the lesson of one of the lessons of the Massachusetts plan and that experiment,
which is something we also talked about, which was a mandated plan.
That was a mandated plan. And I think that what we see there is that we don't have enough primary care physicians, because specialists are expensive. Primary care can also better integrate the experience of the whole person, but we don't have enough. So it's going to
How do you incentivize that? How do you create an incentive for people to go into primary care and not specialists who get retail cash on the barrel head for most of their services, and it means we have a proliferation of dermatologists and not enough primary care physicians?
Well, I think you incentivize it, and we saw that with when Medicare came in. The AMA was absolutely opposed to it, said that they were going to boycott it, but after the law went in fact, most of them came along. The only ones who didn't were physicians who were close to retirement. So I think if we have a reimbursement plan that requires that there be primary care physicians, we'll see movement in that direction. We also see dramatic change on medical schools and how they're dealing with this. They've created these courses called the New Professionalism, in which they're trying to deal with some of these changes.
Well, we're going to have to ask you back as we move through this debate. Bernice Pesco-Solido, professor of sociology at Indiana University and director of the Indiana Consortium for Mental Health Services Research, talking about healthcare. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So we're also talking about governors today. Mark Sanford, you know his troubles. Can you nominate a governor to be in our Worst Governors of All Time Hall of Fame?
Hello, I'd like to nominate a governor. My name is Frederick. I'd like to nominate the nattering napalm of negativism, Spiro Agnew from Maryland.
Great suggestion. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Happy 25th birthday to Purple Rain.
Okay, what's the password?
You got it.
Got what?
The password.
Password is what?
Exactly.
The password is exactly?
No, it's...
Hold it. Slow down.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.